Nikdanis, my daughter. Nikusis, my son. Nimasumsak, my little grandfathers. You must define your own road. I thought I would make it easier if I went ahead in search of what was to lead us home.
For most of her life, Louise Bernice Half Sky Dancer has told her family's story through the language of poetry.
My parents stooped hay, picked rocks in white farmers' fields. In the winter, father brought chipped ice and thawed it on the wood stove. We'd wash our hair and bathe in galvanized tubs.
The former Canadian Parliamentary Poet Laureate has published 4 books of poetry, the first in 1994. Her latest was just released.
The first time I had a shower was in residential school. I hid behind the rags the supervisor provided. In my youth, I danced in torrential rains, lift my arms to the heavens.
Wida Mawick, Tell Them, On a Life of Inspiration, blends memoir, poetry, and essays.
This is where your travel began, a swim, the spark of life, the attachment from which you swam again, reluctant to gasp your first wind. I've entered the womb repeatedly, brought offerings to earn and leave these thoughts.
Wida Mawick is a gift to those who come next.
The old ones told us years would pass before you found your way. The old ones wait as we move among them, willing us to gather their bundles and make them ours.
Danse, Anin, Bujou. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. It's National Poetry Month, and we celebrate and elevate 2 Indigenous poets. During the 2020 pandemic lockdown, Diné poet Jake Skeets happened across a photo of a tragic scene that would inspire his new collection, Horses.
We are at a place of uncertainty in terms of future, and living in regions where water is becoming more and more scarce. And so, for me, very much, the horses became a huge metaphor for us, not just Native people, but people in general.
Plus, great poet Louise Bernice Half Sky Dancer didn't intend to write an autobiography. Instead, Wida Mawick is a lifetime of stories for the next generation.
They're just hungry. Hungry for our spiritual practices and ceremony and language. And I want to pass on as much as I can.
Today, Indigenous poets rooted in land, language, and memory. In 1973, Louise Bernice Half Sky Dancer had a life-defining dream. In it, her grandfather was teaching her how to read Cree syllabics. Many dreams and many years later, she would come to understand the message those dreams were carrying. They were leading her towards a career in writing. Over 50 years later, Louise has traveled and shared her writing far and wide. She has written 4 poetry books chronicling her journey and those who came before her, as well as numerous essays. She has been a poet laureate for Saskatchewan and for Canada's Parliament, and she is a residential school survivor. Her latest collection, Wida Mawick, Tell Them, On a Life of Inspiration, gathers previously published essays and presentations and supplements them with new works of poetry. Louise, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you very much. That was beautifully said.
Well, shucks. So let's get into it. Take us to that first dream. Why was it so impactful for you?
Well, I was living in Kootenai Plains with my parents, and it was a quiet time, and my life wasn't so disrupted, and I started to dream. Well, I guess I'd been dreaming all my life, but the dreams became much more vivid, and that dream was astonishing because I don't read syllabics, but I used to watch my Nimasum, my grandfather, read syllabics on the calendar, and I guess he would be reading the Bible since no written words were available in Cree back then. And in the dream, he was pointing to a book on a page and reading syllabics. It took me a while to figure out that I needed to understand this. And then other dreams followed with more information on how I was to be a writer. And so I had been keeping a journal, but nobody really knew about it. And I just was writing away. And I sent off my first piece to Native Woman Writing the Circle. And Sylvia Banz told me, she was one of the editors, she encouraged me to continue writing, that I had this gift. And it was kind of mind-blowing because I never thought of myself as a poet, nor did I understand that I was really writing poetry. But that's how it came about, and I value those dreams, and I'm still a big dreamer.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you are.
Yeah.
How did you realize that these dreams you were having were showing you the path to your writing career?
Well, when I returned to the home reserve and approached my elders for a ceremony and going on my first vision quest, they confirmed without my telling them or and without their knowledge that I was writing, that this was my vocation. Mm. And what they said simply was, you will write from the universe every day, and you have big wings, travels far, strong back. I've written that phrase because it was so powerful and meaningful to me that I've kept it really close to my heart.
That is a powerful and wonderful dream and you know, assignment to life from your elders.
Mm-hmm.
And from those who don't know what a vision quest is, could you explain that for us?
It's a fasting ceremony where we retreat into the bush, but it's much more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
Where we sit in our little lodges by ourselves for 4 days and four nights. And we go without food and water and just be completely by ourselves, although our elders do check upon us to make sure that all is well. And then we come out at ceremony and we're reintroduced to water, which is very vital and important to us because it's a sacred entity, and to good food. And then he deciphers what went on with us during that period of time.
And then when you were still young, of course, that journey and that path was disrupted by residential school. How did it disrupt your journey?
It went to sleep. And to me, I lost my family. At least we were all displaced. Both my parents went to residential school, as well as all of my siblings. And it destroyed that sense of home and safety and what a home environment should be and be like. We never became a close family after that. Mm. And when I left residential school, I didn't have a sense of who I was, where I was going, or what my goals should be. Although we spoke Cree when the lights were turned out in the dormitory at night or on a playground, we spoke our language. Now, I understand in some provinces, their language was totally eradicated. Fortunately for some of us, we retained our language. But I really had to, like, I knew I had brown skin. I know I could speak some of the language, but I didn't really know who I was because history wasn't presented to us ever. Mm-hmm. We had to learn the colonized way of thinking and perceiving and acting.
Yeah. I love how you say that it went to sleep, the language went to sleep. But even though it was sleeping, you still found ways to speak while attending residential school. How did you do that? Some of the ways, your creative ways that you and the kids tried to hold on to Nehiyawewin.
You know, this is funny because there really is no swear words in Cree, but you could make make up words, and that's what we would do, is we would try to figure out, well, how do you say ceiling in Cree? How do you say this? And we would kill ourselves laughing as we would try to make up these found words in Cree.
Yeah. I'm sure you're very creative with that.
Believe me, I've heard some really interesting ones.
Yeah, who is it? Is it Thompson Highway that says that Cree language is body, B-A-W-D-Y,
yes.
And found in the body, B-O-D-Y. I love that.
Yeah.
In your essay, You Can Do This, Louise, you write, "When I left residential school, I was riddled with burdens I could not articulate. I had no sense of identity, purpose, belonging, or place." How has waking up that language helped you to stay strong over the years?
You know, this is what I love about Cree and the Cree speakers. And many of us in my age group, and even younger now, we're dissecting the language and its real meanings. And one little word can take a whole paragraph or a day of just weaving that word into story. And it's so very lovely. Like, and I'll use this example. A lot of people think penis is a dirty word in Cree. Well, it isn't. It just means little gut or big gut.
I do love how you, you know, you do work with the language, and particularly in this book with your, you know, how you take one word and you expand it into the most beautiful language and poetry. Could you give us an idea of how you've demonstrated how the Cree language is more than just words?
For example, I suppose I'll use the common word that people are familiar with, and that is Wagumatuin, my relationships. And Wagumatuin, of course, is very cosmic. It's very inclusive of all things and of all spirits. And if you look at that word closely, wa is related to wapin, which it means open your eyes, or dawn, like the opening dawn of day. And I still am taking that word apart, but a lot of the Cree languages, when they end up with Giskaydenti, is like, do you understand? But does your heart understand? There's energy in these words.
You talk about, you know, Cree being your home and holding the four dimensions of your being. What does that mean?
Cree being my home, mm-hmm. It's my birthplace. I mention a story in the book, I think. This same grandfather who was reading the syllabics and telling me I should go there reading and writing, when on his dying day, he was at home, and my father and my uncle helped walk him out at the door so he could either say hello to the land I'm returning or just say goodbye. I like to think he was greeting the land and saying, I'm coming home. Mm. And that would be in Cree, Nige. Nikawi, Niki is home, Nikawi is my mother. And that's where it is. It's my mother within myself, it's Cree within myself, and it's my whole entity.
Yeah, and that is a beautiful thought, to think that a language could encompass so much of a person and a culture. When you started to finally share your work with the world, how did you, first of all, decide it was time to share your work?
With this particular book or with all the books?
With all the books, the beginning of your writing journey.
Well, you know, because I was encouraged by these editors to keep writing and by my university professor, and I wasn't, English is not my first language, I don't think of it that way, so writing to me was a difficult endeavor. So to write an essay was really, really difficult, and I didn't grow up with books. So I devoured the books as I was aging in my 20s and 30s. And I became very, very curious about everything and anything. And I would question myself and I'd go sit in the woods with my book and journal after my kids would go off to school and write and ask these questions from the universe. And that's how Bare Bones and Feathers was born. It was really interesting today. I was working with an elder who was in his 60s. He'd obviously read Bare Bones and Feathers. And he said, "So, you're the author. That was horrible, all those stories and memories you wrote. And I said, that's exactly how I want you to react. Because that's what story does. And it tells you what issues you need to address. And that's how Bare Bones and Feathers came. And I said to him later, I said, if I hadn't gone into therapy with a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and with my elders in ceremony, I couldn't write the way I do because it would be too triggering.
Yeah.
So that's how that writing came about. And each book is so different. Like the legend of the Rolling Head was told by my mother when I was growing up. And so I passed that story on to my grandkids. Mm. And Oasis, I was sitting and getting my hair cut, and I was thinking about humor, and I thought I should write about humor. I was talking to my hairdresser, and I said, well, you know what my hair is like. It's kinky and disheveled. And he said, well, why don't you use that as a book cover title? And I said, oh, that's a great idea. So I started researching Oasis and what that meant by itself. As it, Oasis means the spirit we were alone with at birth. And I started asking people, what was their funniest thing that happened to them that they wouldn't dare share with the public? And the stories kept coming and coming. And I asked some white people as well. And you know, that this is the difference between our cultures, I think. White people don't know how to laugh about funny things that happen to them, whereas we fall off the chair laughing.
The more ridiculous, the better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your latest book, We the Mawik, is sharing older essays with, you know, newer poems. How would you describe this book?
Well, these essays and presentations have evolved over 40 years. The first one actually was written for a conference in Italy, in Rome. And I went there, but I never thought of publishing it. But they published it in Italian, I guess. And so I just kept collecting all of these essays and throughout the years as I was doing presentations, not really perceiving that they would become a book. And University of Regina kept pestering me about, send us some material. So I thought, well, I do have some manuscripts of poetry sitting around, but they're not ready to go out. So how about if I give them these essays? And I proposed that I would write a poem for each essay. And they were all gung-ho about it. So that's how this book came about. It wasn't a deliberate act of writing an autobiography. I'm not interested in doing that. But it does have a narrative arc. And the narrative arc goes something like this. There's personal history, both at home and residential school. And then the second part is recovery through culture and ceremony and language. And the third part is about the writing journey. And the fourth part is moving forward and encouraging others to take a handle on their own lives.
That's a beautiful layout. And as much as you say it's not really about you, Suri, it's both instructional and inspirational at the same time, which is what I really enjoyed about the book. And of course, I love poetry. But there's also lots of Cree. And I really like, even though I'm not a speaker myself, I really like trying to read the words, sound them out, and feel it in my, you know, in my being. Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you, you know, to share those pieces of your journey, which include so much of the language and so much discovery and uncovering of it?
It's really important to me because I don't speak the language every day. And when I do meet people who speak the language, I get really excited. And my tongue sometimes forgets, or maybe it's my memory, sometimes forgets a word because of lack of usage. I'm married to a non-native man, and of course I've taught him as much Cree as he possibly can take, and he can get away with it. But it brings joy to my heart when people speak it. And I don't care if they make mistakes with it, because I make mistakes, and I make mistakes in English as well. And that's okay, as long as we're speaking it and preserving it and passing it on as much as we can. Both my kids have made an effort to speak the language, and I'm always sorry that I didn't put it at the forefront when they were growing up, but they're striving, and that's what's important to me.
Yeah. And why did you want to tell, you know, such as it is, these pieces of your story now? Why this book now? Besides, of course, having a publisher that badgers you, which is a nice problem to have, by the way.
Well, I'm almost 73 in a month, okay? I don't have a lot of time left. I'm very conscious of my mortality and my body falling apart slowly as I watch it. My spirit is young and naughty, and I love her. And she keeps me pumping along this crooked body of mine. But the next generation, and I see this in my work with not only the elders and they're talking about it, is that they're just hungry for our spiritual practices and ceremony and language. And I want to pass on as much as I can because, you know, although I watched my Mushum and my Gukum have a sweat lodge in a house, they didn't tell me their story. And I didn't hear it from my parents. And I can only surmise and make something out of that mystery of their lives and try to read from their body language and how they lived together and also to the legends they've kept alive. There's no argument with that. Atayuganak, the sacred legends they kept alive. But everything else about their personal lives went away. You know, they didn't even talk about residential school.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's hard to capture those, you know, pieces of story. And as you say, very important to share, you know, those pieces of story. So in terms of that, you know, passing on Louise's wisdom, what would you, you know, say to the next generation of Indigenous writers as they continue to try to reclaim and rediscover those stories?
You know, the Indigenous writers now, some of them are growing up in a city. Some of them are still fresh off the reserve. And they're doing the best they can. They're enriching other people's lives with the writing that they're doing. And we all have different experiences, different adventures, and different ways of growing and perceiving. And we're not homogenous. Native people are not homogenous, like white people aren't homogenous. There's Italians, there's French, there's Polish, you know, there's Portuguese, all of these people. We're like them. We're different tongues and different spiritual practices. Although we have a lot of commonalities, we're still different in how we live our lives.
Kinanaskamitten. Thank you, Louise.
Well, kinanaskamitten. Looking forward to seeing you sometimes, perhaps in our home country here.
Absolutely. Take care.
It was a pleasure. Hi, hi.
Louise Bernice Half Sky Dancer is an acclaimed Nehiyaw poet and writer from the Saddle Lake First Nation in Alberta. She is now based on the Northern Plains outside of Saskatoon. Her latest collection of essays and poems, Weetamawik, Tell Them on a Life of Inspiration, is available now. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Still ahead.
I end up finding this newspaper article about this horrible tragedy that happened. And I thought, what a perfect metaphor, perhaps. Or how can I explore this as a metaphor for what was happening around us? And the book, Horses, then sort of became this meditation from that moment and from that period.
How an article and a photo inspired Dene'ina poet Jake Skeets to write about the impacts of climate change on the land, its animals, and its people. Taking us there, Mino Bimidisawin means the good life in Anishinaabe Mo'en, as well as a worldview. It's the title of the latest single by singer-songwriter Leonard Sumner. Here is Mino Bimidisawin.
Raise up and tobacco down, gave thanks to the ones that have come before. to sweat as a woody split. You said, you know, I didn't always live this way. Glad he found me when he did. Men on Pamatsu wind. Oh, it's a beautiful life. She heard a jingle, it was in her dream. Said she never knew life could feel so free. As it did when she felt that drum. And she heard that dress was healing. Saved hers from a pawn shop in Saskatoon.
That's Minopi Madiswin by Anishinaabe singer-songwriter Leonard Sumner. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, celebrating National Poetry Month by elevating two Indigenous poets. Try to imagine this heartbreaking scene. 191 wild horses pinned in mud. Some of them thigh or neck deep. Some lie on their sides, some in mid-attempt at futile escape. The horses were found drowned in a mud-filled pond on the Navajo Nation in 2018. A couple years later, Dinette poet Jake Skeets would happen across a photo of the tragedy. It inspired the Navajo Nation's poet laureate to write his latest collection, Horses. Their story brought Jake back to his homelands in the southwestern U.S., where the changing climate is impacting life for all beings. Jake, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you for having me.
So take me back to when you first saw this photo of these horses. What was happening?
It was the sort of middle of the pandemic, actually, and I was living on the Navajo Nation at the time. And as you know, as most Native nations probably across the Americas, were pretty hit pretty hard by the pandemic. The isolation and the lockdown was actually pretty intense where I was. So I was sort of locked in my house, and I was just basically sort of moving through newspaper articles, for actually a different project. I was sort of working toward this idea of a novel, and I was reading through different tribal newspapers from where I'm from on the Navajo Nation. And that's when I came across this article that happened, this tragic event with these horses back in 2018. Yeah, it was a very strange time to sort of like be in the middle of a period where we were all very unsure about what the future might look like. There was a lot of grief, of course, a lot of loss, a lot of anxiety around what might come in the future, given that, we were all sort of locked in our houses and not seeing people. It was a very strange year for me. And I end up finding this newspaper article about this horrible tragedy that happened. And I thought, what a perfect metaphor, perhaps. Or how can I explore this as a metaphor for what was happening around us? And the book, Horses, then sort of became this meditation from that moment and from that period.
And what had happened to these horses in the photo?
Yeah, so the horses were found buried, basically becoming trapped in this mud of a dried up stock pond on the Navajo Nation. So in the Western United States, because water is so scarce, generally for livestock, these stock ponds would be created that would hold water for livestock. And of course, there's a huge feral horse problem across these Western states. So you have sort of roaming herds of horses who are completely wild, sort of moving from water source to water source. So they came across this one on the Navajo Nation that was dried up, probably because of things related to climate change, less rain, less snow melts, less water for everybody. So in their desperation, they began digging into the ground for water, trying to find water, and end up unfortunately getting stuck, and then and unfortunately perishing. And what's interesting is that when they were found, the Navajo Nation didn't have a way of disposing of the bodies or the corpses in any way. So what they ended up doing is sort of burying the horses on site. So they sprayed them with a hydrated lime to speed up decomposition, and then basically covered the entire stock pond, which I find so tragic. This animal, this being that is so central to a lot of different tribal nations, both here in the United States and in Canada, sort of reduced to this kind of like thing to just dispose of and get rid of. So for me, it was a very interesting moment, a very interesting exchange between all these different forces and elements at play that sort of came about at this one singular moment.
Speaking of that moment, would you mind reading us part three, Memorial?
Yeah, and this is from the opening poem, also titled Horses, Part Three, Memorial. I trace the outline of horses encased in hydrated lime, an offering to return bone to loam to groundwater. The horses buried on site to free up the creaks and crease of their pasts, their makeup all song and mourning and mane, here enshrined with the memory of a stock pond. Horses buried thigh deep in mud, clawing for the first world, for something we left behind.
And of course, you're describing the moment that they felt that they had to bury these horses where they lay and died. How did you find that it paralleled what was happening, to you and your community at the time?
Was really awestruck by our government's response to tribal nations asking for help during the pandemic. I know at the time there was news going around. I'm not sure to what extent the truth is here, but one of the things I heard that was happening is when these tribal nations were asking for help, the government instead responded with sending more body bags to tribal nations. And to sort of hear that type of sort of just response was definitely very much in line with what happened in this moment of a tragedy occurring and the government's response to be, let's just get rid of it as quickly as possible. Let's not change anything. Let's not change policy. Let's not take a look to what might be contributing to these types of tragedies, across the region. And so For me, very much the horses became a huge metaphor for us, not just Native people, but people in general. We are at a place of uncertainty in terms of future and living in regions where water is becoming more and more scarce.
Yeah. As you were looking at that photo and it sparked that poetry in you, and much of your work actually centers around poetry and photography and the relationship between those two things. How did that photograph spark that poetry in you, and why do you think that photos often do that, lend themselves to poetry?
Photographs or images can emit a type of sound, and that our bodies are receptors of that quote unquote sound. So it's not sound that we can hear with our ears and our auditory systems, but everything, in the world emits a kind of wavelength or frequency of some kind, right? So images themselves also emit a kind of wavelength, and our bodies are receptive to that. And so when you come across a photograph, you're coming across a sound. And depending on what that photograph is, it might impact you in a particular way. And so for me, and I'm pretty sure this might be true of all people, when they're sort of just going through photographs or even just film, right? They might just be struck by a particular moment that is captured on film or in a photograph. And so for me, I was really interested in trying to explore that more in this second collection, because it also happened with my first book is also a meditation on a photograph.
And in fact, that book sort of is, I don't want, horses might be a continuation of that conversation, of that space between, story and reclaiming story. I might be just babbling.
Oh yeah, no, you're picking up what I'm putting down. Yeah, I've always said that if my first book, Eyes Bottle Dark, with a mouthful of flowers, the first book itself is sort of situated as a kind of ceremony. So it starts with a kind of prayer and ends with a kind of prayer. And so I'm thinking about it as, if Eyes Bottle Dark is the ceremony, then horses the morning after, when you're coming up and you're tired from whatever you've gone through. And you're trying to, get back to where you're from or get back to your house, and you're driving towards your house post this ceremonial moment. There's a particular kind of clarity that happens when you go through a process like that. But then, of course, when you get home, there's no magical cure, right, for anything. There's no epiphany that happens. Instead, you're left with just the clarity and the rest of the day. And it's really up to you. In fact, I think this is really central to a lot of Diné thought and life way and philosophy, that it is up to you, that ceremonies are not supposed to be a magic cure. They're supposed to be the thing that gives you clarity to change things around in your life.
You speak a lot about the land, in your work and in your poems. Could you share a little bit about how you view the land in your poetry and how you related it back to this image of these horses?
That's a good question. I think the land is definitely not an afterthought in my work. The land is probably the only true through line that I can think of in my work as a poet and as a writer. And I grew up on a very small eastern part of the reservation, and that was sort of my whole life for the longest time. But then I met my partner, who was on the opposite side of the reservation. And so my exploration of the res became kind of a road trip, where I drove through as many times as I could all these different places. And one thing that remained consistent or the same, not in terms of aesthetics or beauty, but one sort of grounding element was the land. And on the Navajo Nation, and probably most tribal nations across the Americas, is this kind of like through line of this thing that holds us and supports us. Yeah, and for me, beginning to notice how it's changing because of things like climate change, I know I couldn't ignore it anymore. I had to sort of really sit down and begin to explore it.
And when you say the land has changed because of climate change, what has changed about it?
So I talk a little bit about in my book. I think what I explored the land itself, I did definitely sort of start at the kind of bird's eye view of looking at the types of studies and articles that were being done by scientists, and sort of like noticing the changes in landscape. So things like overgrazing by wildlife populations like horses, right? Because when horses graze, they don't just eat, weeds. They go from root up, right? So they take the entire plant with it. So what this then leaves is sand, right? Sand and soil, because all the vegetation is gone because of overgrazing. But then you pair that with things like an ongoing drought that's been going since the 1990s, right? When there's no rain, and there's no snow, you're left with just windstorms that blow these storms across the reservation. And then, of course, when it does rain, you get these massive floods. And what those floods are doing is just taking more and more of that topsoil away. So what you're left over is with sand, right? And, sand dune migration is a huge thing on the reservation, which I had no idea about. It was only through the exploration of these larger studies. But then once I had this larger view of what was happening, I then went home and actually looked and saw, we had these huge cornfields where I grew up. And as a child, I remember going every summer or every spring and planting corn and planting different vegetables. And then, in the fall, we would all come together and we would harvest them. But now as an adult going back, it is literal sand dunes, right? Because of how much we've neglected the fields. And, on those drives, going across the reservation, I can see it. I can see these sand dunes. I can see the ways in which, there's less and less vegetation. And of course, when you come across these herds of wild horses, it is very difficult to watch because they are so skinny, right? They are feral animals. And again, the image, the iconography, and the semblance of a horse as this powerful being in most native nations, it's hard to sort of see, an animal like that. Yeah, so it's very real. I've sort of seen it with my eyes and sort of, talking through with my family and friends, them telling stories about what it was like growing up, in the 90s when we had regular cycles of, oh, monsoon storms, heavy winter storms, snow melts, right? It was almost a process. But now it's kind of erratic. You really don't know what's going to happen from the month to the next. It could be a heat wave. It could be a cold snap. It could be just wind. It could be these huge monsoon storms that flood everywhere, right? It's becoming less and less cyclical and more erratic.
And how have these changes impacted the way you perceive, experience what is home now?
The land is still a consistency that I sort of find myself relying upon. So yes, as I'm going home and I'm noticing the changes on the land, the landscape, it's still, a homeland, right? I'm still connected to it. And my family is all still there. And I don't necessarily think that we would ever leave, right? My goal as just a person is to work my way back to the reservation. That's the one thing I heard growing up was always, one day you're going to leave the reservation, you're going to go get an education, you're going to get a fancy job, and then when you're ready, you're going to come back and you're going to help us, right? But what they don't tell you is that process takes a long time. It takes you away from the reservation and sometimes further and further away, right? And that's what happened to my family, right? All of my siblings and all of my cousins, we followed that. It took us away from the reservation, and now, the cornfields are not as tended to as they are. But one of my goals is always going to be re to return at some point, right? Once I'm able to, once I have a nice stability, once I have a really thriving career at some point in the future, will be to return.
You say that it is still, of course, a homeland, and your family still lives there, and it is still the place where you come from. Yet there is, carrying a lot of grief in your poetry, in this book in particular. What is it you're grieving here?
I believe my grief is really centered around a kind of change of culture or loss of culture and language in the collective sense. As someone who grew up without Diné as a first language, I feel and carry that grief almost daily. And so in a collective sense, I'm really interested in trying to help both myself and perhaps my community work through this grief to understand that, yes, it's painting this really dire picture, but there are pockets of joy and there are pockets of memory and there's pockets of hope.
another part of the section of the book deals with your queerness unapologetically and beautifully. How do you connect your queerness with your poetry, with land, with climate change, with the things that you're speaking about in this book, with those horses, or are these different things?
They're not different things. There's no way to divorce the land and the body, right? The way that power treats the land is the way that power treats the body. This is the constant question I come across, a constant sort of obstacle, something to parse through, of the division between the land and the body. Because I always think that maybe I'm writing two different collections. Maybe I'll write a collection about climate change and these forces in one book, and then write my queerness and my sexuality in another book, right? But again, that's English as a language, as a colonial language that wants this kind of absolution, that tries to take things away from natural counterparts. And so for me, the land and the body are always connected.
Yeah. Can I ask you to read again Apocalypse?
There has been no rain, and we monster hot afternoons in narrow hollows, metals green and sweep over memories of dew and shorelines now rust and golden with sweat from dry wild weeds, lakelet, heads thrown back, still beams and all. There we trace the outline of bay horses in our legs and the red rocks on the backs of ladybugs. Our hands smell of burning coal, sauntered foxlight and outborne winters. Birds still sing, and from the jaw of a pale sky, dark clouds kneel like you would a shadow. There are ways nature plants a mirror, so each hill and heat burst look the same. Between the ways time has a body, in the layers of skin, each a different shade or century. A rill of vowels with different faces reflect the sun in new light every time. There, each new eternity collapsed into mineral strata on a canyon wall in winter drought, as in a mirror touching time like it would our bodies, dreaming our bodies.
What are you speaking to in that piece?
I'm trying to understand time and the ways in which it shows up in our daily life, because time itself is very profound. But in our daily lives, we experience time through the kind of very minute details of it. Oh, I have a meeting at 3 o'clock, or oh, my appointment's at 11:30, or hey, come meet me in 30 minutes, or I'm running late. I mean, I'm already 45 minutes behind, right? Those types of things is how we experience time on a daily basis. But if we look sort of around us and we sort of see a tree or see a cliffside, or just hold a rock in our hand, right, outside, that's time. That's tremendous time. That's a profound amount of time. But for some reason, we just overlook it, right? We don't see it. We don't feel it. I think even like the wind and the air that we're breathing in, that's time, right? That took time to get to where you're at. And we sort of internalize it right through our breath, so that time becomes part of our body a bit. So for me, I'm really interested in trying to understand what's happening with time and the reasons why we might lose it so often.
So then what are you hoping people will take away, you know, from reading this collection, from that moment in time that you found with those horses, to the shifting of your homelands, literally shifting sand dunes, of climate change, the pandemic, stilling time? There's so many references to this idea of shifting and changing. What is it you hope that people will take away from this collection?
Perhaps one of my hopes that I had, you know, as I was finalizing the book, was that they leave the book with a new orientation to their surroundings. And if it's the smallest notion or gesture of it, that's enough for me, right? That if they put down my book and they take a deep breath and they think, you know, how did this change, or how did this alter my life in some way? I feel like that's enough, right? But for me, at least, my hope is always just the small details. No message per se. Mm-hmm. because I think there's just too many, right? There's too many different, even for myself as the poet, there's too many ways in which I can talk about this book, right? Which I think that's, that's a nice problem to have.
Jake, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for these beautiful questions.
Jake Skeet is the poet laureate of the Navajo Nation. His new book of poetry is called Horses. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Amanda Gear, Elena Hudgens Lyle, and Bridget Stringer Holden. We're going to leave you with one more song from multiple Juno Award winner Elisabe. Elisabe sings in English, French, and Inuktitut. Here she is with her rendition of the Rolling Stones' Wild Horses. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Kinanaskamit Nawa. Agose.
La ngā tō hō mā.